You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 1st, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, we lost Bill Paxton this week.
Oh,
young,
so
young.
Sad.
That sucks.
61, right?
61.
Yeah. You know, that guy, there was something funny about him. Like, I never thought of him as, like, this fantastic actor, but I always loved every character he played. You know, I think he was good in secondary roles for me. Like, maybe not as the lead actor.
Did you
but
watch
he was
Big Love?
So great. Yeah.
I did see a little bit of it, and I did like him in it, but that isn't,
he
like, my
great.
Favorite. Yeah, but I'm more into... I'm more into like sci-fi and stuff like that.
I was obsessed with Big Love, and he was incredible as the patriarch of that family. He reminds me so much of my father. I don't even know how to explain how much. He was born in Fort Worth, right by where I grew up in Dallas, and such a great guy. I got to meet him a couple of times and interview him. It was awesome.
I first saw him in Weird Science. I suppose that was the first movie that I knew him from. You know, science.
He was effing hilarious.
Yeah, he was epic.
I wanted to watch his scene.
But nothing will beat this.
Game over, man. It's game over.
All time. Gosh, we still say that.
Especially that
in our
break
everyday
in
vernacular.
The second over.
I know, his voice
so
cracks.
Perfect.
He ad-libbed that, by the way.
Did he?
That's awesome.
Yep.
Dynamite.
That is definitely one of the most iconic moments in science fiction. Just totally
it
gets
really
it.
It really is.
Because, that moment occurs in so many horror/sci-fi movies where the characters realize that they're effed, and he expressed it perfectly. That's the moment that in every
exactly
one of these goddamn
it
movies.
Yes.
And he nailed it.
Yeah, and his character in the movie Aliens, he had an awesome story arc. You know, he was this cocky D-bag in the beginning of the movie.
Like, but always funny. Douchebag and cocky, yes, but funny the whole time.
Oh, of course, yeah. He played the comedy. I mean, he mixed the reality of the character or the sincerity of the character with the comedy really well. But then, you know, his character becomes like a really important character in the movie and then ends up sacrificing himself, which I thought was like just a cool way. He wasn't just this one-shot deal, you know, secondary character. Like, he had an arc, his character evolved, and was pretty noble at the end. I love that.
It was a good way to go.
I can tell what movie you guys loved him the most in. I remember him so vividly in Twister.
Twister.
So iconic. And apparently, just like Jurassic Park really sparked the imaginations of so many young paleontologists, a lot of meteorologists went into that field because they saw the storm chasers in Twister. And did you guys see the tribute that they did, the spotter network, the storm chasers, where they all turned their GPS coordinates on and spelled out his initials across Tornado Alley?
That is fantastic.
So
Whoa.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I
yeah,
know.
So he was a hero in that culture. And of course, let's not forget, he was Fred Hayes in Apollo 13, wonderful movie.
He did a great job in that film. Yeah, I didn't mean to like take away his acting prowess or his skill earlier in my comment. Like, just I'd never really think of him as a lead actor.
Well, that's a common view. A lot of people don't. And a lot of people, I think, they always say he was like an underappreciated leading man because he was such a character actor.
He was a director as well.
That's right. Yeah.
Frailty. Yeah.
Greatest Game Ever Played, which is, I think, a wonderful movie as well.
Yeah, it was really good.
So, you know, he broke the actor rule for me, which was I typically try to avoid learning about the personal lives of actors. One, because I think it's like, yes, I have a million things that are better to do in my life. But two, because I'm typically disappointed and it spoils a little bit of the coolness for me when I find out, like, you know, whatever, you just insert ridiculous belief here. What I did find out about Bill Paxton was that unanimously, every person that met him, worked with him, adored him and thought he was you keep hearing the same thing. He was an incredible human being. This guy, you know, made people feel welcome, made people feel comfortable, remembered everybody's name, you know, went out of his way to create an atmosphere of comfort around him for everybody else, which I thought was, I love that. I absolutely adore who the way that people describe him as a human being, and it really makes me appreciate him more.
It's nice when celebrities are not jerks.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Kara, you met him, right?
I did. I interviewed him a couple of times, and he was just really, really kind every time I had a chance to meet him.
Kara, I'm curious, did you find him humorous in the interviews? Like, did he have an active sense of humor?
Absolutely. An active sense of humor, but also that, you know how there's two types of humor. There's the people who dominate and show off a lot and need a lot of attention. And then there's that kind of more empathic humor where they laugh at your jokes too.
Yeah,
and I felt like he was definitely that way. He always had a nice, a real glimmer in his eye.
So I've said it before, I'll say it again, death is completely bullshit and we shouldn't have to deal with it. And it sucks when someone so awesome, you know, dies. We never get to meet all of our heroes or people that we appreciate or made us smile. And it's like, you know, hearing that, when I heard that Bill Paxton died, I literally said, oh no, really?
Yeah,
like,
me too.
I was so affected by it. Oddly.
The more unexpected, the more affected.
And younger too, you know? He didn't, like, nothing about him. He's been on a TV show this season. Like, people had hung out with him like 2 weeks before he died, and they were like, he looked fine. So, yeah, well, I think that catches people. But, you know.
Okay, well, let's move on with our show. Kara, you're going to get us started with what's the word?
Yes, I am. So the word this week is a great one. It was recommended by Stephen Spray, who reached out on Facebook. So thank you, Stephen. The word is homologous. Such a good science word. So when we talk about a homologous, let's say, structure, we will contrast that to an analogous structure. It sounds similar, but it's not. A homologous structure is one that has the same relative position, value, or shape, something morphologically similar. And it generally, here's the kicker, indicates a common origin. So like homologous organs, for example, or a good way to kind of put that through is like the forelimb of a human, a bat, a whale, and a dog are all homologous. You can break down the bones and you can see which bones correlate with which bones in each species. They're nearly identical in form, but they're used completely differently, right? One's a wing, one is a flipper. Ours is used for bipedal walking. A dog is a quadruped. So these homologous structures often have structural similarities, but they're not necessarily functional similarities. On the flip side of that, an analogous structure, like the wing of a bird and of a butterfly, have very similar functions, but they don't have anything to do with each other, evolutionarily speaking. They evolved completely separate from one another, and you can't point to like this bone and say it's homologous with that bone. We also use the term homologous in other aspects of biology, like a member pair of chromosomes are homologous chromosomes. So when they all line up before meiosis, you know, one next to one, two next to two, those are the homologs. Also, we might even say that something is homologous if it comes from the same species. Like if you're going to do a tissue graft and you want to use homologous tissue, it'd be tissue from the same species. And then lastly, this is one I didn't know, because chemistry was never my strong suit. Homologous refers to belonging to a chemical series whose members have the same functional group, but they differ by an incremental change compositionally, like the alkanes. Methane, ethane, and propane are all homologous chemicals. So when you look at the etymology, it's pretty straightforward, breaking down homo, having the same, and then logi is actually relation, reasoning, computation, or logos, I should say. So homo and logos, that comes around from, it started as Greek, it became Latinized around the 1650s. If you were to break down logos further, it actually relates to legine. I'm probably pronouncing that really wrong, which means to reckon, to select, or to speak. So that's where we have words like lecture coming in. So it's interesting to see that lecture and homologous are somewhat homologous. They did come from a similar origin.
Yeah, that's a good word. And just understanding the difference between a homologous structure and an analogous structure in evolutionary biology is, I think, a key concept.
Yeah,
it's hard to talk about evolution without knowing those two words.
Absolutely. And it has a lot to do with later concepts we may get to, which are like divergent and convergent evolution.
Right.
So it's definitely something that when you first start learning about evolution, you have to learn these terms because they come around again and again and again.
All right, Bob, I understand that there's a robot. Boston Dynamics made a robot that will give me nightmares. I'm skeptical.
A nightmare robot.
Yes.
There's a robot for everything nowadays.
It's happened again. Boston
Oh, my
Dynamics
God. Oh, sorry.
Has released, they've released yet another iteration of their awesome line of robots. I love each and every one. This one is called Handle, and it's being called Nightmare Inducing, which is actually a little silly. I did not like that. That's what's being passed around. But it's everyone, of course, has ran with that description. But so Boston Dynamics is owned by the X division of Google's parent company called Alphabet. What?
It's called the X division.
It's the X division, which sounds cool. This is Google's parent company, Alphabet. And I'm not happy with them, and I will tell you why later. So I'm sure most listeners have at least heard about Boston Dynamics robots. If you haven't already seen their videos like me over and over and over. So they're known for their incredible balance and dexterity and eerily organic movements. If you kick them in the side, their legs immediately move to redistribute their weight and stay on all fours. It's an amazingly natural movement, but it's a machine. So if you bring them on ice, this is one of my favorite demos, bring them on ice and their legs slip and slide in a way that makes me think of Bambi or some deer on the ice where the legs are just going really fast in lots of different directions and they somehow manage to maintain their balance. It's really a tour de force of programming and mechanics kind of working together. Now, if you look at the history of the robots they've released, they've got their famous quadruped robots, lots of different versions of their quadrupeds. They built a bipedal brother that was also very, very cool. But they've got other things. They've got a little tiny sand flea robot that could leap 30 feet into the air onto a roof or perhaps over a big wall.
Cool.
What kind of wall? So what's new now? How about a hybrid rear-wheeled biped or quadruped?
It's a hybrid.
Somebody asked, by the way, what the hell is that a reference to? Because Jay always says it's a hybrid.
Yeah. What is it a reference to?
California said to me, Bill Murray. Kentucky Bluegrass.
Yeah.
Caddyshack. Just watch Caddyshack. Watch the movie Caddyshack, please. Do yourself a favor.
Oh, how quotable is that
movie? I've been quoting it. So probably since 10 seconds after I heard it in the theater, I said it. And I've been saying it for the rest of my life.
Like early 80s.
25 years ago, yeah.
So let me paint a picture for you of what this guy looks like. So imagine, you know, one of their famous four-legged robots, like, say, Big Dog. Basically, it's a headless dog, right, with the knee joints going in the wrong direction.
Stuff of nightmares.
So imagine that. I guess that's a little nightmarish. So imagine that, but now attach wheels to the ankles of the two rear legs and then have it stand up like a biped, and it's 6.5 feet tall. So that's what we're talking about.
Why so tall?
So it can't walk?
Dude, I don't know. Someone gave that the best description I've heard yet. They said, think Terminator on a hoverboard.
Oh, my God. What? Bob, you know what people are going to say when that thing walks / rolls by? They'll say something like this.
This can't be happening, man. This isn't happening.
Gosh.
So, but
Bill.
That's actually not far from the truth. And that perhaps is why Mark Raybert, founder and CEO of Boston Dynamics, said, this is the debut presentation of what I think will be a nightmare-inducing robot, if you're anything like me. So the news cycle, of course, loved that quote and ran with it. I found one that said, Boston Dynamics' new robot is kind of scary. Fortune had a post that said, Boston Dynamics reveals new nightmare-inducing robot. So everyone's just saying that, just like me, over and over and over. So what's the benefit? Why even go here at all? Rolling is actually much more efficient on a flat surface than walking, which is, I guess, kind of obvious if you think about it. If you're a Ghost in the Shell fan, this definitely reminds me of the bulky and cute Takikoma robots that could walk like a bug, kind of, or roll very, very fast. But similarly, a Handle can roll much faster than it could walk, so that's a big benefit. So if you could roll, and then you could theoretically walk almost anywhere – So what you have is the idea, I guess, is to have this best of both worlds thing going on, without any Borg interference, of course. So that's one of the key benefits here. So the guy, but he could do so much more. Just check out the video. It's amazing. So using the two rear-wheeled legs, it can leap higher than the average NBA player, I'm told, which is about 4 feet, I guess. The leaping is pretty incredible. This guy can get amazing height. They show it jumping onto, while it's rolling, jumping onto a table and then off the table like it was nothing. I mean, it's just so smooth. The video shows it also wheeling down concrete stairs very fast and also down a snowy hill at a decent speed. Remember, these are just wheels. It's just like a biped with wheels, and it's just rolling. It's not really doing anything else but rolling and maneuvering and changing its body a little bit to go into the turns and stuff. So another big benefit is that if you're using just your lower two legs, you're freeing up the front legs for two things: for balance and also for carrying stuff. So they actually showed the robot backing up over a 100-pound box, and it looked like its two arms were like kind of behind it. It kneels down, picks up a 100-pound box, and then just starts rolling forward with it. Very smooth, very strong. So, but another reason apparently that they created this is that it's less complex in a lot of ways. So Boston Dynamics said, Handle uses many of the same dynamics, balance and mobile manipulation principles found in the quadruped and biped robots that we build, but with only 10 actuated joints. It's significantly less complex. Okay, that's good. I mean, less complex is good. It's more hardy, will break down less often, you know, less things to fix. But this is also very confusing because the whole idea of the best of both worlds implies a rolling robot and a walking robot. So if it's far less complex, then how could it really be a fully quadrupedal robot then? In fact, if you look at the video, it only shows Handle rolling and not walking. There's not 1 second of him actually doing any walking. It's all just rolling. And the rolling is awesome and it's cool, but there's no walking. So how is it really a hybrid? So perhaps they plan on merging the fully quadrupedal robot with these wheels, and then you would have that. Or another option I could imagine is that perhaps this is ultimately meant for their pure bipedal robot. So maybe they're just going to put wheels on the bipedal robot. I'm not sure because that doesn't jive with the idea that the benefit is that it's less complex. So that's a little confusing to me. I'm not sure what their ultimate goal is here. I'm not sure how you could have less complex, but also fully quadrupedal and rolling. I was also a little bit dismayed to hear that Google's parent company, Alphabet, may be trying to offload Boston Dynamics. What the hell? Like, they're trying to sell it.
If it's not yielding the profits they want it to yield, then yeah, well, business will unload it. It's a business decision.
Yeah, true, but it's not about profits, apparently. I think from what I could gather, there's a concern with the robots not fitting into the corporate culture, which looks like it's related to the fears that this tech could be terrifying, which is kind of ties into the whole idea of what I the see. CEO well, said. So
right, because if these robots are too scary, therefore Google or Alphabet itself is therefore scary.
But my response would be, yes, robots can be terrifying. That's part of their coolness. Do you think the Terminator movie could have worked if he looked like Wally? No, it wouldn't have worked.
Well, also, let's be real.
Little anime thing with big eyes.
These robots are much less terrifying than all of the big data collection that Google is capable of. Yeah. Hey, is his name Handle?
Stuff you don't know about.
Is it Handle like a door handle or Handle like the composer?
Like a door handle.
Oh, weird. Why is his name Handle? That's such a weird name.
That is lacking. Well, because it's lacking inspiration, in my opinion.
Handle is slang for name.
Maybe.
Yeah. Oh, right. You're right.
What's your handle?
Yeah.
Could be an acronym. Could be an acronym.
That's true.
Right. Handle. Hideous. Amalgamation.
Anthropoid.
Death.
I don't find this robot scary at all, but whenever I do see robots like this, I do think, God, the Cylons would have kicked our ass.
Yeah.
Not even close. Totally. Not even close.
So I'll close with one sentence. All I got to say is, don't worry, Boston Dynamics. I'm sure some other company will buy you up. If you get tossed to the curb, maybe Cyberdyne will be interested.
Bob, that robot's byline is, that's how I roll.
Oh, nice.
So bad.
Hey, Aaron, look, listen. Pay attention, okay?
No, wait.
Comedy is hard work. You got to just keep trying. Every once in a while, something good slips out. People laugh, and you sit back and go, it's all worth it.
Every once in a long while, yeah. All right, next. Jay.
What?
I understand we're going back to the moon sooner than you might think.
All right.
All right, so we don't know if people have had sex in outer space yet, but it's going to happen soon. That's my...
That's your take? That's
my TDLR on this. No, so here's the deal. I am actually not surprised to report that SpaceX, which most of you know is Elon Musk's awesome company, and they are planning to send two private citizens on a pretty amazing trip around the moon. I love it. This is probably going to happen in late 2018. SpaceX is planning in a coordinated effort with NASA to send a crewed mission to the International Space Station. So this seems
not
like
C-R-U-D-E, but C-R-E-W-E-D.
Crewed.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, thank. Oh, thank.
Well, he opened with the sex comment. So
that's right. I did kind of set that up. So, you know, this is probably a test flight for SpaceX because they are planning to start sending missions to the ISS, the space station. So yeah, they're just, you know, they're pushing at the space tourism thing though. So now don't get too excited because SpaceX has already picked the unknown passengers. I don't even know if I would have the nerve to do this.
I think the passengers picked themselves, right? They went to SpaceX and said, hey, we'll give you a chunk of money if you send us to the moon.
Yeah, here's $5 million.
Yeah, they said, the only thing that SpaceX said was that they left a significant deposit.
Yeah.
Funded the trip.
Yeah,
I think it's Richard. Maybe it's Richard Branson.
You never know, right? Would it be funny? And he's up there and he's like dismantling their ship.
I know. He's like taking notes for a virtual dollars.
He's up there to sabotage them. Oh, gosh.
If you were a billionaire, wouldn't you spend $10 million to go to the moon?
Yeah, if I really wanted to. Sure.
I don't want to be the first guy back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want somebody else to go first.
But you're paying to be in history at that point as well. So these two people are going to be undergoing the you know, what you would think as the huge physical testing and the health assessments, and they're going to be doing training later this year, 2017. SpaceX is going to be using their Falcon Heavy rocket. Now, this is an important thing to keep in mind. They have not flown the rocket yet. So
the first
test is coming within the next 4 to 6 months. They said it was over the summer, so I'm giving a time frame of when the summer is going to be happening in the United States. I expect that they're going to probably be having more than one test. And here are some quick details about the Falcon Heavy rocket. It will be the most powerful. This is right off the SpaceX website. It'll be the most powerful operational rocket in the world by a factor of 2, with the ability to lift into orbit over 54 metric tons, 119,000 pounds. Yep, a mass equivalent to a 737 jetliner loaded with passengers, crew, luggage, and fuel. Falcon Heavy can lift more than twice the payload of the next closest operational vehicle, the Delta IV Heavy, at one-third the cost.
One-third the cost.
But Jay, could you compare this? Could you put this in relation to Saturn V payload?
Yeah, so 119,000 compared to 90,000 on the Saturn V. So it's
more. That's more.
Yeah, it's more. So in less than 2 years, guys, space tourism is going to formally be kicked off. This is it. The mission will be really dangerous. It will be dangerous. But as time goes by, other companies like Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin will be entering into the mix, and the number of missions will go up. And, of course, the safety is going to follow because data and refinement and all that stuff will be happening. And
it's just crazy to me that they want to get to the moon before they just do like a parabolic flight.
Well, that's what like Blue Origin is doing. They're going to do just the suborbital flights. But Musk wants to – they're not going to land on the moon, by the way, just to clarify that. They're just going to swing around the moon.
Oh, yeah. They're just doing a flyby.
They'll do an Apollo 13.
So a couple more quick points, guys. Within a decade – this is my opinion, but I think within about 10 years, we're going to see monthly missions into space. And that is the world I want to live in, by the way, is – frequent trips to outer space. SpaceX is also planning an unmanned mission to the International Space Station this year, with a manned mission to the station planned in the second quarter of 2018. NASA is actually paying SpaceX to first resupply the space station, and then soon after that, they're going to start transporting crew back and forth. Great, and I think this is a low cost, a way for NASA to save money and get the job done.
Yes, yes.
Interesting side note. NASA recently decided to try and add actual people to their Orion spacecraft missions, Maiden Voyage, and they're conducting a feasibility study to see if it's feasible. See if they can do it. See if it's safe.
No, I think it's just, it's a, I don't know if it's a coincidence or if, you know, there was some connection here, but it's interesting that, yeah, this is the Space Launch System. They're going to send a test flight of the Orion capsule to swing around the moon. And now they're thinking about putting people on the Orion and swinging around the moon. And part of the reason was that they're concerned that if they don't do something a little dramatic for the public, their funding is not going to be sustainable.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's a marketing decision. I think it's a great one.
It's essentially a marketing decision.
Yeah. I mean, they're sending up a capsule that can hold people that will be – and they'll be testing everything. You know, they just have to factor in, okay, is it safe enough? Yeah, is it safe enough? You know, how long are they going to be up there? You know, because it's not going to be hours. It'll be days. A cool fact is that if they do send people up with it, it will coincide with the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11's first manned mission to land on the moon. I think that's wonderful.
That is very cool.
Yeah, I think 50 years is a perfect round number for that.
Now, took us long enough.
This, the Orion spacecraft system, guys, this whole thing, the SLS and the Orion spacecraft, they're built to take people to Mars. That's the whole point to this thing.
Yep.
And, you know, they need to get the public behind it and get excitement happening again and really, you know, have there be some political will pushing their budget. So I'm all for it.
Well, I've always thought using the moon as the stepping point to Mars in a lot of different ways makes the most sense.
Absolutely.
Even from a public relations standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there you go, guys. It's cool stuff ahead. And, you know, I am so excited to see humans back in space going beyond Earth orbit. You know, the fact that we're going to have a couple of missions going to the moon. Excellent. Keep going, guys.
Okay. We have sort of a technology theme at the beginning of our news items. Evan, apparently there's a downside to this digital age we've created. Tell us about that.
Apparently so, in the way of disorders. And this came from the website The Week. The headline reads, 5 new brain disorders that were born out of the digital age. Yeah, well, I want to clarify just a couple things. So they said 5 new brain disorders. New, which I get is a relative term, but the author, Tammy Cannon, she's basing her article on a study that was published in August 2016. So maybe in analog times, that's considered new, but in the digital age, it's like 100 years old.
Yeah, but in neuroscience, that's really new.
It is. So I'm willing to say that, you know, I'll give it the benefit of the doubt that it is new. And then disorder. So it's, to me, that's kind of a nebulous term. I mean, it kind of sounds official in one sense, but by definition, while the DSM-IV explains, the concept of mental disorder, like many other concepts in medicine and science, lacks a consistent operational definition that covers all situations.
Yeah, that's true. But, there is a core definition that is fairly consistently used. In order to be considered a disorder, you need to have some kind of behavioral or whatever parameters that are outside, you know, 2 standard deviation outside of the typical human variation. And it has to be directly related to demonstrable harm, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's, then it's a disorder.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be
okay,
atypical.
All right. I knew there had to be some guidelines
for this. And it has to cause
this.
Harm. And so, yeah, right. Like, I'm going to be talking about this more in the next news item on ADHD. We'll get to it in more detail.
Well, the study itself that she refers to was titled Cognitive Offloading, How the Internet is Increasingly Taking Over Human Memory. So these were researchers from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. They found that cognitive offloading, that's their term, which is the tendency to rely on things like the internet as an aid to your memory, it increases after each use. So if you think that memory is something that just happens in the head, it's increasingly becoming something that happens with the help of outside agents of the head. And this is what the authors who conducted the experiments tried to determine our likelihood to, say, reach for a computer or a smartphone to answer questions instead of relying on our own raw brain power. Now, the study was this. So participants were divided into 2 groups to answer some challenging trivia questions. One group used just their memory, and the other group got to use Google. The participants were then given the option of answering subsequent easier questions by the method of their choice. And the results revealed that participants who previously used the internet to gain information were significantly more likely to revert to Google for subsequent questions than those who relied on just their memory. Got that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We are tending towards becoming slaves to the technology around us. Now, these 5 new disorders that that this particular article from The Week described were as follows. Number one, nomophobia. So, as of course, phobia is a fear. Nomophobia is short for, yeah, right, that's right, no mobile phobia. Feeling a panic one has upon being separated from one's smartphone or tablet.
I totally got that.
I hate that.
A lot of people have that.
I think it's a real thing. In the United Kingdom, they took a survey. 73% of respondents felt panic when they misplaced their phone. Panic or panic attack.
Yeah, but terrible. That's different. Like, it's different to say, I don't know where it is. Like, it's not convenient. I can't check it or look things up. And holy shit, I lost my phone. That's a $900 piece of equipment that has my entire life in it.
Yeah.
I find a distinction between those two things for sure.
Yeah, well, that's
leaving it at
definitely.
Home and being like, crap, I have to get through dinner without my cell phone is completely different than thinking you lost it.
I agree with that. Yeah, so there is a distinction there to be made. Number two, technoference.
Interfering with daily lives by like having a screen between you and your partner or something.
That's right. Yeah. Essentially, smartphones are getting in the way of things like our sex lives. Mm. For example, 40% of people in one study said that they'd postpone sex because of smartphone use. You know, what planet they're living on. Some admitted to hurrying through sex just to answer a phone call or read a mobile notification. Oh my gosh.
That was just becoming? Their excuse.
How do you how do you hurry through sex?
Well, Jay. That's relative as well.
Jay, we'll take this offline.
Number three, this one we've talked about before, the phantom ring. Or the faux, or the
pareidolia kind of a thing.
Ringxiety is something. Yeah. Let's see. They studied this phenomenon and 320 adult mobile phone users, 2/3 of them reported experiencing phantom ringing. That is, they actually heard their phone ringing when it actually wasn't. We've talked about it in the context of the phone vibrating. Mm-hmm. If it's somewhere on your person, it's kind of you're sensing a vibration, but it's really not doing
it. Or like if there's white noise.
Which I've experienced.
If there's white noise, like when you're taking a shower, I've heard my phone ring. So that could also cause that to happen.
So I keep my phone, and I think it's just a practice from being on set so often. I keep my phone on silent with no vibrate, which is a pain when I can't find it. Because people are like, do you want me to call it? And I'm like, it does not matter. I will not hear it. Right. But because of that, or there's a correlation, I never get that phantom thing. I used to when I was young, but I never hear a phone ring. I never think I sense a vibrate because my phone doesn't do that.
The fourth disorder, cyberchondria. You've heard of hypochondria? This is cyberchondria. In which people who research and diagnose their own illnesses online.
That's still just hypochondria. That is not a new illness. Yeah. It's just using technology to
none of these are. None of these are actual.
Well, that's
true.
Well, that's what I was getting towards. Is that right? Are these really disorders?
Yeah.
Like,
we have more data than we used to.
Habits or something. Yeah. You know, so I'm not really sure that you can call it. The last one's called the Truman Show delusion. So from the 1998 movie The Truman Show, you have a feeling that. The main character, Truman Burbank, had that feeling about someone's watching him all the time.
We're all living in a simulation.
You're right. Yeah, it's sort of the take on the simulation. But apparently that's, you know, some people feel that that's definitely happening in our digital age. I've never really felt that. I mean, I know that cameras are kind of, you know, everywhere nowadays. And a lot of things do get recorded, but not to the point where, you know, I have a disorder, I would say, or I change my habits to some measure of certainty that affects me on a day-to-day basis.
But that's also not new. You know, there are just
none
people
of these
who constantly feel like they're being watched.
Well, none of them are new. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, that's why I kind of brought up at the beginning, like, how, you know, not only is it not really that new a study, but are these really new phenomenon at all? And are these really disorders?
Well, they're definitely not diagnosable. There's no codes in the ICD or the DSM for these things.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't think like the first, you know, three are not disorders at all. You know, nomophobia is not a disorder. These are just, you know, these are interesting phenomena in that they're new cultural, you know, phenomena with the digital age, but these are not new disorders. The first ones are not disorders at all. And then the cyberchondria and the Truman Show delusion are just existing disorders you know, in the context of living in a culture with digital technology. That's all.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like people with delusions. Those delusions have always related to the culture in which they're embedded, right?
Sure. Oh yeah.
Or you think you're being bugged by the CIA? That isn't CIA, you know, delusion. That's delusion that is appropriate to whatever the cultural context is. That's it. You know, cyberchondria is that's just hypochondria. People have been looking up. I'm telling you, back in the 80s, they would buy a book at Barnes and Noble that was a list of symptoms. They would do the same exact thing, just using whatever access to whatever information that they had.
Yeah, everybody said that when WebMD came out. You know, everybody thinks they're sick because of WebMD. It's like, no, they just like to think they're sick. It's a new tool.
Yes, new tool. Yeah.
I tried to think of a historical parallel to this, and maybe around the time that, say, electricity, evening lighting, and these sorts of things sort of became ubiquitous. Was there also this sort of cultural changing, or were people affected somehow?
Yeah,
negatively, like with suddenly lights on all the time.
And then they're like, workaholism. It's the new craze. People stay up long past the sunsets to do their work.
So,
well, everyone, we have to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Blue Apron.
Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the United States. And did you guys know that? The cool thing about this service is that they deliver to you a box of ingredients that are specifically measured for the recipe you're going to make, for the amount of people that you chose. So there's no wasted food. You don't throw any of the ingredients away. I just think that that alone is a really good way if you want to be, you know, mindful of the environment and not wasting food. You're really not going to waste anything when you use the Blue Apron service.
It's also really, really affordable. I'm talking less than $10 per person per meal. And you get a home-cooked meal out of it. You know, that's cheaper than going to a restaurant, and you actually get to be in control of how the food is prepared. And you can take that time to bond with your family, which I know is something we could all spend a little more time doing.
So here's just a tiny taste of the featured upcoming meals. There's salmon piccata with orzo and broccoli, whatever orzo is.
Orzo pasta. Is like
whatever orzo
is. Pasta.
It's rice-shaped pasta.
That's the size and shape of rice. Yeah.
It's also the name of a magician.
I kind
of
knew that, but I was going for the funny right there. So
yeah, I gotcha, but I can't let that go past.
Okay. There's also pork chops and miso butter with bok choy and marinated apple. There's vegetable chili and baked sweet potatoes with crispy tortilla strips. And last but not least, there's spicy shrimp coconut, curry with cabbage and rice.
Yep, get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/SGU. That's blueapron.com/SGU.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. So let's move on to a real disorder.
Yeah.
ADHD, or Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. It's actually disorder.
And that's in the book. That's in the real DSM-4. Thing. Yeah.
So a recent article, actually, it's been the last couple of years, some permutation of this article, but in January, in the Curious Mind magazine, listen to this headline. Renowned Harvard psychologist says ADHD is largely a fraud.
Fraud.
Yeah. So this is talking about Jerome Kagan.
is that legit, Steve?
No, it's bullshit.
True ad.
But let me tell you
why.
Is
he a Scientologist?
No. Jerome Kagan is one of the most famous psychologists in the world. This guy is a legit, you know, ranked one of the most eminent psychologists of all time. So no question this guy has credentials. But what's interesting is that journalists make very, very common mistakes when they write articles based upon individual scientists. So first, they mistake the opinions of an individual scientist with scientific authority, because that's the journalistic way, right? You find somebody with proper credentials who can back something up, and there you go. You cite them as the authority, and you're good. But you can't. That doesn't work in science, you know, because one person never represents the consensus of scientific opinion. It's a crapshoot. They may or they may not. They're giving you their own opinions. And they're unless you're asking them the correct questions,
yes,
they may not be reflecting to you what the consensus of scientific opinion is. Plus, also, it's hard sometimes to know what the appropriate expert actually is. And in neuroscience, there's different ways in which neuroscience is sliced up. So, you know, a psychologist is not a psychiatrist, is not a neuroscientist who's
researching.
Not a neurologist, right? Yeah. These are all different skills. And why, while Kagan may be a revered psychological researcher, he's not a psychiatrist. He makes a lot of, to me, in my opinion, naive statements that only someone who either has an axe to grind, which may be the case, or isn't a clinician would make, you know?
Can you distinguish those specialties, Steve? Because I think it's probably confusing to how they're different.
So yeah,
some of them sound very similar.
And there's subgroups of psychology as well. So there's clinical psychology and research psychology and development.
And there's clinical neuropsychology, where if that's your specialty, maybe you are more capable of talking about these things.
It's very confusing. But the thing that you do need to know is that there are people who primarily do research, and then there are people who are primarily clinicians who treat patients. That's true in neurology as well. I have colleagues who are mainly researchers. And you're either dealing with neurological disorders or psychiatric disorders. So either it's probably easier to define the psychiatric disorders. They deal with disorders of mood, thought, and behavior. And neurological is basically everything else, but there's a lot of overlap, so the distinction's not really clean.
And it's really common that people with neurological disorders also have psychiatric disorders, secondary to
as I said, there's a lot of overlap, A lot of psychiatric disorders present to neurologists because they have neurological symptoms, you know. But in any case, what happens is if you have somebody who's either not a clinician or not a clinical or not a clinician in psychiatric illness, you know, disorders of mood, thought, and behavior, but who is in some other aspect of neuroscience, they could be perceived as an appropriate expert by a journalist who doesn't understand the nuances of the different, you know, specialties within neuroscience. And so this guy's like the perfect storm, a very famous psychologist who is then touted by like, oh, what an expert. I mean, like they spend the first 2-3 paragraphs just talking about what an expert he is. So then that gives them leave to just recount his personal opinions as if it's definitive.
Is he an ADHD expert?
No. And he's,
and what credentials does he
what
have?
The heck?
Like there are people where that's their whole practice is ADHD, or that's their whole research lab.
So let me read you some of the things he said that I really took exception to. I went into it in a lot of detail in my science-based medicine article today. But like, for example, he says, let's go back 50 years. We have a 7-year-old child who is bored in school and disrupts classes. Back then, he was called lazy. Today, he is said to suffer from ADHD. That's why the numbers have soared. So just try to break that down a little bit. That's like a really, really horrible example. 50 years ago, first of all, really? Of course, these diagnoses are much more common today because they just weren't being made. That should sound remarkably familiar to
autism.
You about autism. Same thing. Autism rates are not actually skyrocketing. It's just that people are just diagnosing it. Now, sure, there's no question that people are diagnosing ADHD today when they wouldn't have 50 years ago. But also, he makes a lot of mistakes when he ends up attacking a straw man of ADHD because he doesn't at least acknowledge the standard of care. That doesn't mean that every practitioner is adhering optimally to the standard of care, but you at least have to acknowledge what it is. So all of his criticisms are already accounted for by, you know, actual clinicians who are diagnosing and treating this, including, so he says, a student who was bored in class would be diagnosed with ADHD. Actually, that's not true. Because right in the diagnostic criteria, it says you have to have the symptoms in more than one location. If you only have them at school, you do not meet the diagnostic criteria for ADHD.
Oh, there you go.
Now, that may seem like a subtle difference, but that's exactly the kind of difference an actual clinician would understand, you know, somebody who actually diagnoses ADHD. And they have to be persistent, and they can't be explained by any reaction to your situation or to anything else. And you can't account for them by any other condition that might explain them. And you have to, they have a certain number of them that have to be severe and persistent
So it puts you, again, two standard deviations out of the range of what's age appropriate. So,
those things, he kind of nailed it.
Yeah, the point is, so yeah. A lot of criticisms are don't even account for all the things. It's like right there in the DSM. That's the description in the DSM. All of those things are already accounted for. They go, oh, they're diagnosing it in normal kids. Oh, they're diagnosing it just in kids who's
well, then that's a problem with the person doing the diagnosis, not with the diagnostic criteria, if that's really the case.
If it's happening,
not.
Right. But there are studies that show it's actually not being massively overdiagnosed at all. Okay. Now, I found a good statement by a psychiatrist who actually is a clinician, and look at the difference in what Kagan was saying and what an actual expert in this area is saying. Here's the quote. ADHD is real. It's not made up, but it exists on a continuum. There's no marker or white line that says you're in the definitive or highly likely group. There's almost unanimous agreement that 5 or 6% clearly have enough of these symptoms for an ADHD diagnosis. Then there's the next group where the diagnosis is more of a judgment call, and for these kids, behavioral therapy might work. And then there's a third group on the borderline. These are the ones we're worried about being pushed into an inaccurate diagnosis. That's the end quote, right? So there's somebody who knows what they're talking about who said, yeah, listen, it's real. There's 5 or 6%, no question that they have it. Then there's the gray zone, which is, again, there's no sharp demarcation line. So it's where do you want to draw the line? And then there's the kids who probably shouldn't be diagnosed. And that's the group you want to make sure that doesn't get overdiagnosed. They may have just a few of the symptoms. So that's a much more nuanced, careful approach to this question. Without calling it a fraud and criticizing it without even really accounting for what's actually happening in the real world.
It sounds like there's also something that's being ignored, which is not just the nuance of the types of kids or whether or not they're borderline ADHD, but there's different types of ADHD, right? There's inattentive ADHD, there's impulsive, hyperactive, there's combined. And I think people, they hear the word hyperactivity, and they think that they all have to be hyperactive, but that's not true. There are kids who are just predominantly inattentive. So not only do you have to qualify across the board on all those diagnostic criteria, then, maybe they're a different subtype, and that's why they don't present the same way.
All right, I got to read you another quote. This kind of puts things into – this is an interview with Spiegel he's doing. Experts speak of 5.4 million American children who display the symptoms typical of ADHD. Are you saying that this mental disorder is just an invention? And Kagan responds, that's correct. It's an invention. Every child who's not doing well in school is sent to see a pediatrician, and the pediatrician says, it's ADHD. Here's Ritalin. In fact, 90% of these 90% of these 5.4 million kids don't have an abnormal dopamine metabolism. The problem is, if a drug is available to doctors, they'll make the corresponding diagnosis. So, that's just bullshit. I'm sorry, but that's just BS. Okay. Again, first of all, even allowing him some hyperbole, every child who's not doing well in school, I mean, come on, that's an exaggeration. But even if we just put that aside, pediatricians are not necessarily overdiagnosing ADHD and overprescribing Ritalin. We have data on that. But what's interesting, he gets into he says 90% of these 5.4 million kids don't have an abnormal dopamine metabolism. And that struck me. It's like, why the hell is he picking out dopamine metabolism of all things, as if like that's the marker for ADHD. Now, it is true that there have been some studies which show that children with ADHD have impaired reward system circuitry. So they do have impaired, dopamine function in their reward system. But that's like a side phenomenon of ADHD. That is not the core neuroanatomical correlate of ADHD. Let me tell you what the actual neuroscience says about ADHD. Your frontal lobes are responsible for what's called executive function. And there's two main things going on here. One is the ability to focus your attention, right? Which is a very high energy frontal lobe function. That's why, by the way, we say don't multitask, because it takes up so much mental energy to shift your attention that it interferes with whatever tasks you're trying to do.
At what age do you develop that, Steve?
Your ability to focus your attention? Yeah. It's kind of like 6 or 7 is where, you should you really shouldn't even diagnose ADHD before age 7.
But then it keeps developing until you're like in your early 20s.
Yeah, even beyond that.
Wow.
Even beyond that. So
adult brains are different than teenage brains in that respect as well. But then the other thing is what we call executive function, and that's the ability to weigh your options and make strategic decisions for your life and to inhibit your desires, inhibit your behavior because you know that it's the right thing to do or the strategic thing to do. So that's executive function, right? What the name implies. And that accounts for the two, you know, the main subtypes of ADHD, the inattentive mm-hmm. type and the impulsive, I can't inhibit my behavior type.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everything you think should be the case if this were an actual brain disorder where that those parts of the brain responsible for those functions aren't working is what we find when we look at the brain. If you do EEGs or functional MRI scans of people who clinically meet the diagnostic criteria for ADHD, guess what? Their executive function and their focus attention areas of their frontal lobes are not working as robustly as people who don't meet the diagnostic criteria for ADHD. It is a demonstrable brain disorder. We could see it. And it's not – then you know what the critics wiggle out by saying, oh, that's just the medication that you use to treat the – that's bullshit. It's not the medication you use to treat ADHD. It's so – you know, there have been enough studies looking at medication-naive subjects to show that that's the case. It also makes absolutely no sense. Again, it's like we know what this part of the brain's doing, and guess what? It's not working as well in these patients, and they exhibit the exact symptoms you think that they should have if this part of the brain isn't working. Further, it's genetic. The genes that correlate with, you know, brain proteins, guess what? They're markers for ADHD. Now, you can't use any of these things to diagnose ADHD because, like many – brain disorder, because like with autism or with migraine or with any complex neurological disorder like this, it's multifactorial. It's, yeah. it's really a category of multiple things that all have as their final common pathway some function that is disordered. So,
and not just that, even when something's like close to simple dominance genetically, it's still just a predictor when you look at those snaps.
Yeah,
like, I looked at my 23andMe and it says I'm highly likely to be blonde.
Right. And you're not,
you know what I mean? But I'm not blonde.
Yeah.
Right. It's like my genes say, and based on my, you know, I should be, but I'm not.
Yeah.
And that sometimes happens. So if you try to diagnose just based on your genes, you're going to have so many false positives and false negatives.
Yeah, but plus just the brain itself is wicked complicated, right? It's lots and lots of circuits all interacting in a complicated way and interacting with the environment. And we're looking at the net result of behavior. And it's not like that's one circuit in the brain. You know, it's going to be it's multiple things interacting. And there's probably lots of different ways you can get to this ultimate clinical picture of having inattention or hyperactivity. So no one test is going to have the sensitivity or specificity to be as useful as just a clinical diagnosis, you know? But they are important research tools that help us understand what's going on. They're just not useful clinically. But again, critics falsely equate clinical utility with being real. And if you can't make the diagnosis with an MRI scan, it's not a real disorder. And again, that's BS. It's just naive. Mm. It's not true. That means you understand nothing about the neuroanatomical correlates of psychiatric or neurological disorders. So for Kagan to make this a nonsensical comment about dopamine, as if that is somehow a summary of all of the neuroanatomical data we have. So here is a review of the neuroanatomical correlates. Let me read this for you. Convergent data from neuroimaging, neuropsychology, genetics, and neurochemical studies consistently point to the involvement of the frontostriatal network as a likely contributor to the pathophysiology of ADHD. This network involves the lateral prefrontal cortex, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, some other structures. Moreover, a growing literature demonstrates abnormalities affecting other cortical regions and the cerebellum. So the data is robust. I've been following this data for literally 30 years. It clearly shows that ADHD is a brain disorder. Parts of the brain that you would think should be involved are involved. Not only that, as an adult neurologist, I treat lots of patients who essentially have acquired ADHD. And you know how they acquire it?
Frontal lobe damage.
Cell phones.
Yes, tablets.
No, too much sex.
Brain damage.
Yeah, frontal lobe damage.
Yeah, carriage, right. Frontal lobe damage. They get into a car accident. They hit the front of their head against the windshield. They damage the same parts of the brain, and they get basically the same symptoms of ADHD. And guess what we treat it with? The same kind of stimulants that you use to treat ADHD.
Jesus.
Okay, so this makes me – I love to bring this up whenever we talk about frontal lobes, because did you guys ever see the movie Saw?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember when they finally explained why the protagonist, or the antagonist, sorry, in Saw did what he did and came up with all of these, you know, scary, intense, convoluted, like, death chamber scenarios?
They explained that in the first movie?
Yeah, in the first movie. Oh, they explained it, and they said that he had been in some sort of accident and he damaged his frontal lobe. And I got so mad because I was like, sure, that would make him a little more impulsive. But to plan, to see the future and plan these really intricate death scenarios, that's like the one thing he couldn't damage to be able to have done this. Yeah. It was
it's like these people get hit on the head and they can talk French.
I'm like, it's like you're almost there. Ugh, made me crazy.
So let me just finish with this thought, which is something that I think is very important. And there's a couple of things in here. First of all, if you're going to criticize an entire profession, you know, you better make sure that you have your ducks in a row. You know, this is a – and it, you know, this guy, you know, I respect him in terms of what he actually does, in terms of his history of psychological research.
His
but he doesn't
specialty.
Doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to ADHD, but he's being presented as this definitive expert making these outlandish statements that are ultimately clinically naive. And invalid logically and factually, in my opinion. You remember the principle of charity, you know, to try to understand something you're criticizing in its best light, not its worst light. It's sort of the opposite of a straw man. That would go a long way to protect you from falling into this kind of a trap. And the other thing is that criticism always has to be put into context. Actually, interestingly, you know, before we started recording the show, we were talking about John Oliver, and he had a great analogy where he was talking about how, like, the false equivalency that a lot of people use. And he said, yeah, that's like saying that La La Land, and then he named some, like, really horrible, like the Human Centipede. These are both flawed pictures. Yeah, they are. They're both flawed movies. And La La Land, there was these minor problems, you know, the guy was looking at his feet when he was dancing, whereas the Human Centipede is a piece of crap from beginning to end with no redeeming value.
But literally.
But you could say
– Really?
Yeah, but you could say – that these are both flawed movies, you know, and then leave it at that as a false equivalency.
Yeah, right.
So, I'd still rather watch Human Centipede, just saying.
Yeah, but that's
Bob, what are you smoking, man?
I watched it with Ashley. It's very nostalgic.
But you could do – whenever you criticize a field, you have to put that criticism into context. Like, because we criticize the institutions of science all the time, but what we're saying is science is awesome, science works, but these are some problems that need to be fixed so it would be even better. Other people use the same criticism to say science is broken and we could ignore all the findings of science, and they're just not putting those criticisms into its proper context. So Kagan actually has some, you know, there's a kernel of truth to some of his criticisms in that, sure, we do have to think very carefully about the risks versus benefits of where we are drawing the line here and how we are prioritizing different treatments. But that doesn't mean it's a fraud. You know, that is way, way, way overcalling it. And I don't think he at all justifies that. You know, and unfortunately, the press is eating it up, hook, line, and sinker.
Sure.
Oh, my God. So, Steve, it's kind of – I keep being reminded during your talk about Linus Pauling and vitamin C.
Yeah, yeah. Same thing. Exactly. All right, Jay, who's that noisy time?
What do you want from me?
I want a noisy and then an answer and then another noisy.
That was the right answer. Okay. All right, so last week I played this noisy. Why is that funny to me?
I'll tell you what, that does not sound like a theremin.
No, it doesn't.
It sounds like a cross between an animal and a weed whacker.
A weed whacker is definitely the best guess I've heard so far.
It has a chainsaw kind of tone to it. It's not a chainsaw, though.
All right, so this is, I'll give you a hint, this is a motor.
Oh. Yeah.
What kind of motor is it?
I know, it's a slowed down nano motor.
No, it's an air motor.
What's an air motor?
It's a motor that runs off of compressed air.
Oh.
Awesome.
Okay.
This was sent in by a listener named Jake, and unfortunately, there were no emails this week because our email was down.
Conspiracy.
Yes. We've been having trouble with our email server for some reason, and we have our tech company working on it, and it goes down every once in a while. So I'm sorry. If you sent me in an email, I mean it. I'm sorry. I don't know if I'll ever even see them at this point. So
Everyone wins this week.
Yeah.
Everybody's a winner this week. Yeah, if you did send the SGU any important emails outside of Who's That Noisy, because once I reveal what it is, it's over. It's all over. You know, resend us those emails when you get this, and we're sorry. To make it up to you, I have a really fun and pretty provocative Who's That Noisy this week. This was sent in from a listener named Adam Bellows. Check this out. This is going to be the kind of noisy, like, if you know what it is, you really know what it is, okay? If you don't know what it is and you're going to try to figure it out, I do believe you deserve a clue. And the clue is, it is nothing without its entirety.
Okay.
All right. It's a provocative clue for a very fun and provocative noisy. Kara?
It's not a theremin.
It's not a theremin. It's not a whale or a monkey whistling through his teeth.
It does sound like a harpsichord, though.
It's not a frog with a tuba. Okay.
Is it that Boston Dynamics nightmare robot on a harpsichord?
Yeah. And I will give you another hint. Yes, that's a computer playing musical notes.
Yeah.
That's not the answer. It's what's the underlying thing
answer.
Here?
Yeah.
It. So anyway, please continue to email me with cool noisies that you heard this week or a guess or just to say hi at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right. Interesting email. This is a follow-up to our tinnitus discussion that we had last week. So the email goes, listening to your latest episode right now, great job. As always, when Steve mentioned that fleeting tinnitus was the result of hair cells dying, though, I thought, isn't that a myth? A year or two ago, a friend described his occasional experience with fleeting tinnitus, and I shared my experience, too. One of us mentioned that it had to do with hair cells dying. We found we both had this idea floating around in our heads and traced it back to Alfonso Cuarón's film, Children of Men. Awesome
so
movie,
good.
By the way.
Yeah.
Awesome movie. Mm-hmm, where mm-hmm. Julianne Moore tells Clive Owen that the ringing he was hearing was the last time he'd ever hear that specific frequency because the relevant hair cell was dying. We were both interested to find out if this was true. We're both linguists and concluded it wasn't. Rather, we surmised that this ringing came about from a kind of feedback loop that gets triggered in the hair cells and drowns out other noises. They link to a Zidbits article. Any idea if we were on the right track? Is this just a myth? Is there some truth to it? Thanks.
And that's from Stefan, sorry. Or maybe Stephen. I can't tell. Hertubis, hopefully.
Okay. So this is an unbelievably complicated story. And the answer is we don't know.
Huh.
So I tried as best as I could to try to find out, like, what do we know about what is happening during tinnitus. Tinnitus is, of course, is a noise or a ringing or a tone in your ears. There's lots of different kinds of tinnitus. Here we're talking about what has, in a 2011 article, was dubbed sudden, brief, unilateral tapering tinnitus, or S-butt. What I think the authors of that article coined that term, because then I searched on that phrase, sudden, brief, unilateral tapering tinnitus, and I could not find any other references to it. But what they're talking about is a spontaneous tone that you hear usually in one ear that lasts for about 30 seconds, and then it slowly fades away.
Right.
And while it's there, it kind of drowns out other background noise And then it resolves. And it may be associated with a sense of fullness in that ear, but it's like less than a minute, the whole thing from soup to nuts. Right? You guys have all had that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yep. Absolutely.
Of course, no, yeah.
Have yeah, not. So you have not, randomly. Bob. That's interesting. So this was an epidemiological study. They were just trying to find out who has this, you know, and when. So here were the results. 76% of the participants recalled having at least one S-butt in the past. There was no significant difference in the incidence of S-butts with respect to handedness, age, sex, the presence or absence of chronic tinnitus, whether tinnitus could be brought on by exposure to loud sounds, or whether auditory perception could be modulated with strong muscle contractions of the neck or jaw. In study two, S-butt's mean rate was 1.2 per month. The rate in people with chronic tinnitus was twice that of those without chronic tinnitus. Right ear S-butt's predominated nearly 2-1. That's very interesting. Pitch estimates range from 0.1 to 4.4 kilohertz. 75% of S-butts lasted 25 seconds or less. A quarter occurred with simultaneous ear fullness. So, yeah, about a quarter of people didn't recall ever having them. Three quarters of people do have them. They happen a few times a year, you know, on average, about one a month.
Wait, what's simultaneous ear fullness?
You have a sense of fullness in your ear.
Oh, I thought like your ear was full of something.
No, it just feels like it is.
Gross.
Okay, so that's one very specific type of tinnitus, this sudden unilateral tapering tinnitus. We don't know what causes that, but I did read the Zidbits article that they referenced, and they describe an interesting phenomenon, which is, the ear does have this feedback loop, this positive feedback, which is supposed to amplify the very softest sounds to make them louder. And sometimes that could just run away and you get this 30 seconds of feedback, and it takes time for the compensatory dampening mechanisms to kick in and, you know, return your hearing to homeostasis. But the thing is, that's just a theory, and it's a good one. It's perfectly reasonable. It does fit the characteristics of that very specific type of tinnitus. So that's a good hypothesis, but even in the references that article gave, and I read through them, I didn't see that any definitive discussion that we know for sure that that's what's causing it.
So is the hair cell dying also a valid hypothesis, or is that really just made up from a movie?
No, the movie did not make it up. The movie was that may be what they remember it from, but this belief goes way back before the movie. But there are related forms of tinnitus which definitely are associated with dying hair cells. And we know that because if you study the people who, after they have the tinnitus, they are missing those tones. When you do an audiogram, like you map out every tone they could hear, they have relative hearing loss in the tone, in the frequency of the tinnitus. So there's also something called sudden onset tinnitus. And sudden onset tinnitus may or may not be accompanied with hearing loss. So definitely, if you have sudden onset tinnitus with hearing loss, that is associated with a loss of hearing in the frequency range of the tinnitus. Those hair cells are dead. And what you're hearing is the disinhibited input, you know, from those now dead cells. There's also tinnitus, and this is relevant to the movie, you can get tinnitus from a loud noise.
Yeah, your ears always ring after you leave a club or like a concert.
Sure. Yeah, or you hear a firecracker go off close to you, that'll trigger it.
That is associated with hearing, with death of those hair cells.
Steve, but you're not, you know, you've got to have more than one hair cell in your ear that hears a frequency, right? It's like one of the hundreds of hair cells per frequency or something, no?
You know, the way the cochlea works is it's basically a long tube lined with hair cells, and the cochlea slowly tapers as it curls around. And so the resonant frequency in the fluid in the cochlea is based upon the diameter of the cochlea at that point. And because it just tapers, you know what I mean? So it's analog, it's not digital in that in the tapering of the cochlea itself.
So it's just where your hair cell is along that line.
It's where the hair cell is. So it's digital in that you have 1,500 hair cells in one ear. So each hair cell is in a frequency based on its where it is in the cochlea. And so every hair cell is different even from its neighbors because it's in a little a bit of a different location. But most sounds are going to activate multiple hair cells, yes. Mm-hmm. Right? Because it's like even though the vibrations are resonating at one location, it's not going to be so precise that you're only going to be hitting one and only one hair cell. That's correct. And there's going to be undertones and multiple tones, things like that. It's a vibratory system, you know?
It's still fascinating that you really do lose that, I mean, that wavelength, which is...
Well, yeah, so the hair cells specific. That are damaged by the loud noise, the tinnitus is their sort of their death throes, and you then lose the hearing in that frequency. But that's traumatic tinnitus or from a loud noise and or spontaneous tinnitus with hearing loss, but... they are correct in that S-butt, you know, the spontaneous unilateral tapering tinnitus, there's no reason to think that that's associated with dying hair cells. And there's a really good hypothesis that it's just a feedback loop. And also, the thing is, I couldn't find the definitive, here's the definitive answer to it. And there's so little published on it. I really wasn't getting a lot of results on PubMed. And even when if I could find the right term and then I search on the correct terms, then I get the mother lode. I just never got there. I just don't think it's there. I don't think it exists. We need to do a lot more research to figure out what's actually happening. What's interesting is that, that feedback loop may be occurring in the brain and not in your ear. And the reason we think that it's essentially the modulation of your perception of sounds in the brain. Why else would there be occur twice as often in the right ear than the left ear? There shouldn't be any right-left difference if you're just talking about the ears themselves, but they're thinking that may correlate with handedness in some weird way. Anyway, that's still in the area, I think, of speculation. But there are good reasons to think that this is happening in the brain and not in the ear.
Yeah, I mean, we forget that we actually do hear with the brain. The mechanism is our ear, but we encode that in the brain. That's why, like, there are certain surgeries where if you poke someone in the right place in the temporal lobe, they'll, like, hear shit that's not in the room.
Right. Or seizures.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So I guess I wouldn't call it a myth. It's just more complicated. Some types of tinnitus, yes. Some types, no. The actual type that Clive Owen had in the movie because it was traumatic, yes, that is dying hair cells. But the totally spontaneous tapering tinnitus, probably not. We have some interesting ideas about that, but I don't think we have a definitive answer.
Fascinating.
So cool. It's fascinating. Yeah. And we still don't have any treatments for tinnitus. Sorry. There's no treatments that are.
But effective. This homeopathic thing says.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there is. There's homeopathic treatments for tinnitus. It's all BS. And the things that have been studied don't work. The supplements and whatever. Ginkgo biloba doesn't work. None of it works. So we still don't know how to treat it is the bottom line. There are things that could distract you from it, could mask it a little bit, but nothing makes it go away.
When are they going to spend $1 billion on this and just solve it so people don't have to suffer?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Imagine if you actually could come up with something, that would be a huge seller. A lot of people have tinnitus.
Almost like noise-canceling headphones, but like tonal-canceling hearing aids. That's an interesting approach. Yeah.
It distracts you.
Oh, yeah. Like a phase inversion sort of device to cancel it.
Probably makes your life a lot easier. You know, it probably makes things worth living a lot more than they are. These people who have just crushing, oppressive tinnitus where they can't even focus or hear. I can only imagine.
Living with migraines, I imagine, is like the equivalent.
Or my mother-in-law.
I was going to say, your mother-in-law has tinnitus?
she gives you migraines?
I get you.
I love her. She's awesome.
Yeah. Keep telling yourself that. All right. Let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fakeroni. And I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Got three regular news items this week. I think you'll find them interesting. Are you ready?
Yes.
Here we go.
Yes.
Bob is.
Item number one, paleontologists have found the world's oldest fossils, at least 3.7 billion years old, in Quebec, Canada. Item number two, the 94-year-old inventor of the lithium-ion battery announced a new battery breakthrough that has three times the energy density, more recharge cycles, greater stability, faster recharge, out of cheaper and environmentally friendly materials. And item number three, a new study finds that American homeowners actually lost over $1 billion last year, that's 2016, by refinancing incorrectly. Bob, go first.
Older fossils, I just generally always go with that because we're always pushing that envelope. There's you know, that's a very hardy envelope, and it's not going anywhere soon. So, I could totally buy that. 94-year-old inventor of the lithium-ion battery. That's a cool invention to claim. Yeah, I invented the lithium-ion batteries. So now, but he's like one-upping it big time. I mean, this seems like a little bit too much goodness here. Three times the density. Holy crap. 300%. Seriously, that's huge. The other ones are a little bit more nebulous. More recharge cycles. Okay, how many more? Greater stability. Okay, how much more stable? Faster recharge. Okay, how much faster? You get the idea. It could be a little or it could be hugely significant. Who knows? And then to top it all off, it's also cheaper and environmentally friendly materials. I mean, come on. So that's a little bit much. But damn, I hope it's true. And then we got this other one here at the end. American homeowners lost a billion. Wow, that's a lot. I mean, I know squat about that crap. Who knows? It certainly is feasible. I guess I'll go with the battery. That's just like too much goodness going on there, I think.
Okay, Kara.
All right. I kind of agree with Bob. Usually the oldest fossil thing seems to pan out. World's oldest fossil, 3.7 billion years old, so it must be bacterial. It's always amazing when they find stuff like that. But I don't know. Sweetenly. So I kind of think that one's science. Nothing about it bothers me. 94-year-old inventor of the lithium-ion battery. I love this. Announced a new battery breakthrough. Of course he did at 94. That has three times the energy density, more recharge cycles, greater stability, faster recharge, out of cheaper and environmentally friendly materials. This is one of those ones that's annoying because it's probably science, but if it's not science, it's because like something in the list is wrong. I don't know. Let me look at the last one. A new study finds that American homeowners actually lost over $1 billion last year by refinancing incorrectly. That sounds like low, to be honest. I think this one's the fiction because I think they probably lost a hell of a lot more than that because people are dumb when it comes to their mortgages and they make terrible decisions. So I'm going to say that we lost a hell of a lot more than $1 billion.
Okay, Evan.
So the first one about the fossil, 3.7 billion years old. That's old. The world's oldest fossils. I think I agree with Bob on this one that this one's going to turn out to be science. Next, the battery. Three times the energy density. Boy, we talk about batteries all the time, and you know it's a slow crawl. Battery technology is a slow crawl. This sounds almost too good to be true. Almost. And the fact that, you know, a man 94 years old still active in battery technology, I think that in itself is a remarkable thing. You know, we should all be so have it still in our brain at 94 years old to be doing this kind of stuff. The last one, homeowners lost over $1 billion by refinancing incorrectly. Jeez, I think I'm with Kara on this one. I think $1 billion is a lot of money. I think it's a lot worse than that, and I think it's going to wind up being tenfold worse than that, $10 billion probably. So I have a feeling that that one's the fiction.
Okay, and Jay.
Yeah, so we have this 94-year-old fossil found in Quebec that invented an awesome battery, but in the end lost a ton of money on his mortgage.
That's right.
Yeah, so the first thing I thought of when you said 3.7 billion years is what was alive 3.7 billion years ago? And then Kara, thankfully, threw me a bone. And
it was horses.
Yeah, it was horses.
I just saw those at the museum.
It was the mermen. Yeah, so they found a fossilized, some type of biology, bacteria, whatever, virus, fossilized. I don't see any reason to disagree with that. My question always is, how the hell do they find that? You know what I mean? Like, just walking around, picking up like something, you know. They have to know where they're looking to find stuff that's that old. Was it, you know, in amber? I don't know. Look, Steve, this is crazy stuff. But something is 3.7 billion years old on the planet.
Yeah, not amber, but yeah.
Yeah, whatever. All right,
who's amber?
Exactly. All right, so the 94-year-old guy that was a co-founder of the lithium-ion battery This one is absolutely science. So therefore, this last thing about the billion thing, I mean, I'm kind of agreeing with you guys that, you know, when you add up, you know, we have a few hundred million people, you know, how many own houses, and you know, you add up the dollars, absolutely, you know, you can get to $1 billion very fast. I think you blow way past $1 billion. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure, but I do agree that that one is the fiction.
Okay, so you all agree.
Oh, no.
Paleontologists have found the world's oldest fossils at least 3.7 billion years old in Quebec, Canada. You all think that one's real, and that one is science.
Yay!
Yeah, so what was it? What was it, Steve?
Yeah, that was easy, but I had to include that one because it was cool. It was horses. It was horses that were 3.0. It's back to
God, you asshole. You totally screwed me. Now I'm going to remember that shit like a month ago and be like, yes, horses were alive 3.7 billion years ago.
That's right. They found them in the same level as
science podcast.
Same layer as dinosaurs.
You have some checks and balances going on in your head.
Microscopic horses. That's what they were.
More like a hippogriff than a horse.
So prior to that, the record was held by West Australian microfossils dating to 3.4 billion years old. So this extends it significantly. It's at least 3.7. It could be as much as 4.3, probably not.
What?
But that's
Earth's only.
Hold on.
Well, what is it, 4.5 billion years old?
That is the formation that it's in. The sedimentary rocks are between 3.7 and 4.3. billion years old. That's why I said at least 3.7. Whoa. It's somewhere in that range. Wow. Probably not at 4.3, but that's the range. Okay.
Australia must be pissed.
Yeah, because Australia always had the oldest rocks.
So these are also better. About that. These are better, more definitive that these are. So these occur in iron, in what's called hematite. You guys know hematite, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's magnetic. Yeah.
These are probably iron oxidizing bacteria found near hydrothermal vents. So this supports the hypothesis that the first life on Earth evolved around these volcanic vents.
Neat.
Yeah. So, and they found filaments, tubes, centimeter-sized structures called concretions or nodules, as well as tiny spheroidal structures called rosettes and granules. All they think are the products of putrefaction. That's a good word, by the way.
Ooh, what the hell does that mean? I love that word.
It's when something putrefies.
Yeah,
decay. Part of decay.
Yeah, kind of decomposition. Decomp.
Putrescine. Right. Yeah, decomp. Putrescine is a chemical.
Body buried in the ground.
And think the other cadaverine. One is cadaverine. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
What?
That's and bugsy. They smell really bad.
The cool thing, though, is that this is like a double-edged sword of awesomeness. Because not
it's a double-edged lightsaber.
Yes.
Wow.
Because not only did life happen pretty much right after the Earth started cooling. I mean, it's like amazing how life just popped out so fast, so near the birth of the Earth. So there's that. But it also means that Earth, that single-celled microorganisms hung out for at least 300 million more years than we had previously thought. Until... And it makes you think that single cells could have just never gone to multicellular, and then Earth would just be single-celled microorganisms. It's just, you know, like it's more of a fluke. It makes it seem like more of a fluke to have multicellular life now.
Yeah, because we basically had single-celled life for 3 billion years. And then about 600 or so million years ago, you know, the multicellular life started to evolve. So I do wonder what's one of the things that I would be fascinated to know is like when we start to like really explore the galaxy and let's say we find life on planets, are what percentage of planets with life are going to have just single cell life?
Yeah.
Like really the vast
microscopic
majority.
Right? Yeah.
But that's good because that just means we have to get a bunch of good rock samples. That's all we need.
Right.
Just get some soil. Bring it back.
But imagine.
But Bob, is it going to be 90% or 99% or 99.9%?
Right.
Yeah, that's
right.
What I
imagine you're an alien. You visit Earth like over 3 billion years ago. And I'm like, all right, bacteria's here. All right, that's pretty cool. They came out pretty quick. Let's come back in a few more billion years, see what's going on. They come back 3 billion years later. It's like, what? Still single cell. This place is never going to amount to shit. And they take off.
Pop goes, and they never come back.
Yeah. 3 billion years later, and they're like, what's going on here?
I'm not investing in this
planet. Lazy bastards. Evolve already, for Christ.
Of course, they were evolving.
Right,
that
true.
Whole
true.
Settle down, Steve. Wow.
Yeah, into horses.
That's why. No, which I point that out because like creationists say, oh, how unlikely was it for a single cell to spontaneously form? You mean a modern single cell that evolved over billions
spontaneously
of years?
Over hundreds of billions of years.
All right, item number two, the 94-year-old inventor of the lithium-ion battery announced a new battery breakthrough that has three times the energy density, more recharge cycles, greater stability, faster recharge out of cheaper and environmentally friendly materials. Bob, you think this one is too good to be true, so it's the fiction. The rest of you buy this one and think it's science, and this one is science.
It is science. Ooh.
Three times the energy density.
Yeah.
Guy's awesome. He's 94 years old. He co-created the battery.
Oh.
And
his name is cool. John.
Good enough. I know. What was with that name? Hey, you got that.
I guess he thought that the lithium-ion battery wasn't good enough.
No, but imagine if he named the product after himself. It's a good enough battery.
Yeah, so this comes from Austin, Texas. A team of engineers led by 94-year-old John Goodenough.
Good for him, man.
Developed. Yeah, he's co-inventor of the lithium-ion battery. So this is a battery using essentially sodium instead of lithium. Sodium is, you know, like in salt, sodium. And this is using solid glass electrolytes rather than liquid electrolytes.
Ooh.
Now, they've been working on this for a while because there's a number of potential advantages. Because it's solid, it doesn't form the kind of structures when it gets recharged. The filaments, you know, like when you recharge a battery, each time you do that, it forms these little dendrites. Mm. And those dendrites have a couple of negative effects. One is it degrades the capacity. That's why the recharge cycles diminish over time, because those dendrites are taking up some of the electrolytes. And also, these dendrites, sometimes they can get big enough to actually form a short circuit, and that's when the battery goes on fire.
That's not good.
So, but with these solid glass electrolytes, there's a number of advantages. I didn't even tell you all. There's one more I didn't throw in there. Not only does it have three times the energy density, significantly more recharge cycles. They said they've tested it at least 1,200 cycles.
Nice.
Yep, that's nice. Previously they couldn't get the solid state batteries to function at less than 60 degrees Celsius. That's a problem.
Yeah,
this one, this one was functional up to negative 20 degrees Celsius.
Oh, wow.
You're good.
Yeah, so that's good. That will cover pretty much, you know, most temperatures we operate in.
It seems almost too good to be true.
Yeah, I'm always, when I read battery things, this is why I included this one. And Bob's the only one, unfortunately, got sucked into this. But it's like, I'm waiting for the, but there's this one little thing that's a fatal flaw, right?
No.
And I just didn't
massive
see
radiation
it. Like, okay,
dosage or something.
Yeah.
Right. So it's stable.
You can't hold it.
It's not made out of platinum. You know, it has good recharge times, good recharge cycles, good energy density, cheap material. What's the downside? I couldn't find
there's
it.
No,
so I still think there may be something we don't know about. Like it's, can't be manufactured, whatever. I don't know.
Yes, but we are so jaded. We have earned
I know.
That
I'm jaded.
Right. We have totally earned it.
But I want to be surprised. I want this to work out because, hey, you know, hell, even if you just go with the three times the energy density.
Oh, my God. Everything else being
imagine,
the same,
that's a,
that would
that's
be
a nice
intense.
Step. Nice step.
Yeah, imagine electric cars. Instead of going 200 miles, they go 600 miles.
Kara.
Yes, I can.
That's a game changer.
It's a game changer.
Come on.
It's a game changer.
Take that,
absolutely.
Gasoline.
And they don't catch on fire. That'd be nice. Plus, also being highly functional at low temperatures means that regenerative braking works better.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, like in Connecticut, like often when these hybrid cars,
it's a hybrid.
Give you like their mileage. That's in a warm environment where the regenerative braking is functioning at optimal efficiency. And then in like the winters of Connecticut, they would plummet to almost nothing because you just can't recharge the battery quickly when it's cold. But you know, if you have a battery that really has a good operating efficiency down to negative 20 degrees Celsius, then that would mean that the regenerative braking would be efficient even in the winter, right? Basically what that would mean. So that would be great. That would be good. So I hope this is as good as it seems. You know, I haven't found the chink in the armor yet, but maybe someone who has more technical knowledge of this specific paper than we do can clue us in if I missed anything. What's the downside? I don't see it. I mean, obviously the big thing that they didn't talk about – because we haven't done it yet, is, yeah, as Jay said, it's in the lab. So will this be amenable to some kind of mass manufacturing process? That's always that final piece to the puzzle. Okay. If you can't mass produce it, who cares? You never hear about that in these articles at this stage, because I think because they just don't know. We just don't know. So we'll see.
I'm getting excited. Damn it.
That's okay. This is optimistic. You have reason to be optimistic, I think.
I know. I was like, stop being excited by this. It's not going to be true. It's not incremental. It's too revolutionary. Right? But whatever. I mean, hopefully this all works out.
This goddamn world deserves something like this. Come on. We need it.
And the fact that a 94-year-old guy, John Goodenough, did it, is just the icing on the cake. It's a wonderful story, right? It's just, you know, you gotta want it just for that.
John Goodenough. It's so good.
Enough. Well,
all right. This means that a new study finds that American homeowners actually lost over $1 billion last year by refinancing incorrectly is the fiction. You guys are sort of right about why it's the fiction, in that the actual figure was higher, but it was also something else. So they actually they didn't lose money by refinancing poorly. They failed to take advantage of refinancing. Mm-hmm. So they didn't refinance when they should have. And the estimate is that they lost $5.4 billion by not refinancing when they should have.
Mm. Yep.
God, we need to refi. So, this is just kicking my ass. Like, I got to
do it soon because the rates are going to go up. I know the Fed's about to raise. Yeah, they're about to raise.
You really got, when the rates drop low enough, you really lose a lot of money by not refinancing.
I know. And the thing is, we've been waiting. Like, our mortgage broker has the papers ready, and we were waiting for it to cross the threshold that it hasn't crossed. And so I think we just have to pull the trigger.
Yeah, you do. It's going the average.
Yeah.
Even with conservative assumptions, the median household stood to save $1,920 per year by refinancing, almost $2,000 a year.
And I live in I live in LA in a decent house. 30-year mortgage? It's going to be a lot more than that.
Now, the one thing is, like, I didn't refinance with the recent drop, but that's because I was already so far into my loan.
That's right.
I've already paid off all my interest.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
I'm paying I only have like a year or two left on it. I'm paying almost all principal, and so refinancing at that point would be dumb.
No, yeah, that's great.
But if you're still paying off your interest and the rates drop by a point or two, you're freaking which we did.
Yeah.
We did when, like, the last time the rates dropped really low, we refinanced and we got such good rates that we were able to do a 15-year instead of a 30-year.
Nice.
Holy crap.
And that's why we're close to paying it off.
Sweet.
So that saves you a boatload of money too.
We could never
if you can afford the 15-year, do it, because you save a boatload of money over the lifetime of the loan.
Wow.
Or if you're disciplined, just pay it off faster if you can.
Yeah.
Cut down the years.
We do that too. We tack on an extra bit and say, apply to principal.
That's true. That's always a good way to do it. I'm taking that extra bit right now and putting it in my retirement savings, which is also
That's cool. good as yeah. well. Very good.
But are you getting more interest on your retirement savings than you're paying on interest on your loan? That's what you need to figure out.
I am, because I'm only a 35% shareholder in my home. But probably overall, not.
That's the kind of thing, you know, I don't know a lot about finances. I really wish I knew a lot more. Mm. It is one of those things that, you know, I feel like I'm always leaving a lot of money on the table because I'm not investing a lot of time in really understanding my finances. I mean, I do have a financial advisor, you know, and plus if you work at a university, like, the one big perk they give you is you could just take advantage of all their financial advisors. So they'll just tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And you get the TIAA CREF, which is a really good retirement savings program for teachers, you know, which applies.
You actually have, like, as a freelancer, I have to use a SEP IRA, a self-employment pension plan. It's the only option I have available to me. So it's really about, you know, making sure I put enough of a percentage of my income into it. And then I assume 9% over the life of it, because I'm just straight in index funds. So, you know, it seems to be the case. 9%. Yep.
Defer whenever you can. Defer your income later in life when you're taxed at a lower rate. That's the general
that's the
philosophy.
Yep.
But yeah, people, you do have to pay attention to that, because, you know, it's a lot of money when you map it out over over your lifetime.
For sure.
Yeah,
hundreds, really, it could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, you got to make good decisions, and it's worth investing the time. But a lot, what the point of the study was, yeah, a lot of people are just leaving money on the table because they're not doing basic things like taking advantage of ridiculously good refinancing opportunities.
Yeah, or you know what other people do all the time is they work for a corporation that offers a 401k match, and they don't take the match.
Oh, because they're
like, take the match.
Yeah, people do this all the time because they're like, I don't want my paycheck to be smaller. And it's like, it's free money.
Max out the match.
Always take the maximum of the match. It's free money.
Defer, defer as much as you can, whenever you can. Defer, defer, defer.
Take it from Evan. He's an accountant.
Please.
And take free money.
I see it every day.
Don't say no to free money. Yeah. But it's also, it's really good. The match is good because it's such a good incentive to just save every month.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know? And that's what you need. You need the thing is, I could, this is the mistake. People are like, oh, I'm in my 20s. I need the money now. You know, I'm going to make more money.
Oh, gosh, no,
you don't.
But you know what?
Yeah. The earlier you save, the better.
Yeah. It's so, you really got to do it as early as you can. Oh, I know.
Yep.
Save early. Be disciplined. Take the free money. And, you know, and have, it's one of those things, it's like, you know, you got to understand healthcare enough that you're taking care of yourself. You have to understand finances enough that you're not making really big mistakes.
And take it from me, if you live, if you work for a company and they're willing to do this monthly out of your paycheck and give you free money, it is easy for you to do it. Suck it up and do it. I have to like calculate at the end of the year what percentage of my income, and I make this big lump payment at the end of the year, and it can kick your ass, you know? Like, it's much harder to be disciplined that way. If you have a 401k, you're one of the lucky ones. Take advantage.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah.
Do it
now.
Do it.
All right. Good job, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bob, that was a tricky one.
Oh, Bob.
Bob.
You're all right, Bob. Yeah, you'll be fine.
Bob's like already, he's already gone to bed.
Yeah.
Is he still here? Hello?
At least you could hear. At least you're like not hearing the death of hair cells in your head.
True. All right. Evan, give us a quote this week.
Here we go. I have no data yet. It's a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. Ah, the ageless wisdom of Sherlock Holmes.
Ooh.
From The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite Holmes.
If only Arthur Conan Doyle listened to his character more often, then perhaps Doyle would not have gone down in history as a, someone who was on kind of the opposite side of reason and critical thinking.
Yeah, he didn't like the Holmes character. Thought he was a jerk.
Yeah, tried to kill him and everyone freaked out, like, oh, shit.
So he loved Moriarty then.
But I have to say, that maybe as an investigator, that might be a good plan, but as a scientist, you have to have theories. You collect data in the context of what theory you're trying to test, you know? So that doesn't really apply to science, I have to say. I get the idea. The idea is you don't want to commit. You don't want to emotionally commit to one answer before you look at the data, because you will then invoke motivated reasoning, right? That's what he's saying. Mm-hmm. That's true. But you know, in science, you have theories. You can't pretend like you don't have theories. And in fact, you should be collecting data in order to test your hypotheses, right? It's what's data without hypotheses, you know, in science. So it's different. You just have to follow the process of science so that you don't engage in motivated reasoning. Science is about making sure that you don't do that, right? So if you're following, your biases should be filtered out of the process if you're doing it right. So I don't fully agree with this. I get the core principle is correct, but there's much more nuance there, right?
I hear you. Absolutely.
But I love the Holmes character.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yes.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, brother.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.
We'll be right back.